Phoenix FM.
I'm joined in the studio by an incredible musician who I had the privilege of meeting last year at the Essex Jazz Course, which is here in Brentwood. It's saxophone player Derek Nash, who's been a member of the Jules Holland Rhythm and Blues Orchestra since 2004, and he's led Sax Appeal for over 30 years. He also fronts the funk fusion band Protect the Beat and is a member of the Ronnie Scott's Blues Explosion. Derek has worked alongside Paul McCartney, Amy Winehouse, Eric Clapton, Annie Lennox, Tom Jones, and that's to name but a few, and he's here in the studio today. Look at that for a showbiz introduction.
I'm very impressed. Very impressed with the music as well. I thought it was the Pearl and Dean music for when it started with the little bongos.
Yes.
Oh, well, lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. It's lovely to see you again. As I said, I did meet you last year at the jazz course, which is in Brentwood.
Yeah.
And we will talk about that a little bit later because it is fantastic for anybody out there of any level who's interested in jazz. If we start at the beginning, your dad.
Yeah. Matt,
he worked for the BBC Northern Dance Orchestra, which he did for 35 years. What influence did he have on you musically?
Absolutely massive. I mean, firstly, my lifestyle at home is I always presumed that everyone else's dad put on a dinner jacket and a bow tie and went out every Saturday night. Didn't everybody's dad do that? Because that's what my dad did. Mm. And he would go out and play. So that seemed perfectly normal lifestyle. And my house was always completely full of music.
Yeah.
Apart from my dad working for the BBC Orchestra, he also played piano. My mum and dad were involved with the local amateur dramatic societies. So there would be rehearsals at home. There'd be people singing in the lounge. One day Ken Dodd would turn up. The next day Graham Gould from 10cc would turn up the next, so people would just come into the house, and I just perceived this as normal. I was just enveloped with music.
Mm.
And you know that half term thing, and you don't know what to do with the kids.
Yeah.
Just go to work with your dad today, because so I didn't have to go see a plumber or go and sit in an office. I went and heard a 17 piece big band in a recording studio.
Yeah.
Doing sessions for Radio 2 at the time. So I was absolutely enveloped with music from a very early age and loved every aspect of it.
Do you think if your dad hadn't been a musician, do you still think you would have gone that?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. I'd like to think so. I mean, academically, the three things that I could cope with were physics, maths and music. Those were the three things I could cope with. And actually, music is physics and maths joined together with a bit of soul put in on top of it. And then how we somehow control it as a human being and put the emotion into it is the important thing. So that's what I've always been good at. I was playing piano at six. And like a lot of kids, I found that the constant just practice this, just play classical music. I think I always probably had an urge to play a little more and to start to improvise. Nobody told me that I couldn't write music.
Mm.
I just said, well, I've just invented these three notes and I like them.
Yeah.
So no one said, oh no, composing music's very hard, you can't do that. I just started, and I had a lot of support. My father used to help me with arranging, and I'd start writing something. He'd say, oh no, don't do that, or that chord's wrong, or just try these notes instead, and explained why they worked. So I'm very much school of life. I ended up not going to music college. It got complicated at school. I couldn't do music and physics. I had to do one or the other. So I ended up doing physics, going on doing an acoustics course instead.
Yeah.
At Salford University, and then joined the BBC as a sound engineer, all the time playing saxophone in the background.
Yeah.
And basically paying my way through college and earning money by playing saxophone. So I've had this joint career now for a long time as a sound engineer and as a saxophone player, and I run my own recording studio and record lots of other people's jazz. So I hugely enjoy it. I either record it all day or play it all night, and I find both help.
Yeah.
When I'm in the studio as a sound engineer, because I speak the correct language, people in the studio, it's so easy for me. If someone says, let's take it from the third bar of the bridge, and I might know, I would probably recognise when there might be a mistake from something or something didn't feel quite right.
Yeah.
Because I've been in bands just like the ones I'm recording.
Yeah.
Vice versa, when I go into a recording studio, I know exactly what can and can't be done.
Yeah.
Very quickly, and I feel totally at ease. Some people get very scared going to a recording studio. They feel nervous with all the microphones around and the padding and all this kind of business. Well, for me, I've lived that in that environment for so long. I'm very relaxed, which means I enjoy recording studios. They don't scare me at all.
What about the first piece of music you wrote? Do you have that anywhere? Have you got what was it called? Do you remember?
Wow. No, I can't. I know I've got things. I know I've got songs that I entered for school music competitions somewhere. I know I can still vaguely remember some of those that I've written. I know the first thing I ever wrote for Sax Appeal was a thing called Jumpin' at the Plowboy, because that was a pub that we played in when I was about 15 years old.
Yeah.
First place we ever got a proper gig of Sax Appeal was the Plowboy pub in Disley. So I wrote a tune called Jumpin' at the Plowboy, which was doo-da, 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 boo-da, doo-ba, doo-ba, doo-da, da. And I've still got that somewhere.
Yeah. You didn't frame it. Just
no, no. I keep thinking one day what I should do is expand it, write a whole bit and turn it into a fully-fledged piece. One day. Because quite often you find a lot of people, famous people, the songs, the amazing songs that we love them for, were written very, very early on.
Yeah.
I was listening to the Radio 4 documentary on David Bowie, interviewing him, and realising that things like Space Oddity and things like that were written so early in his career.
Yeah.
Ridiculously classic songs when he was only 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
You know, they were amazing songs written at that stage. So a lot of people shouldn't disregard the stuff they write intuitively.
Yep.
At a very early age, because it can be very strong material, and you should always, I think like all musicians, you keep a pad of ideas and sketches. I now sing things into my phone all the time if I get an idea. I'm currently just being commissioned to write something for a jazz club called Watermill Jazz Club in Dorking.
Yeah.
And I've just been commissioned for something for the end of March when Sax Appeal are doing a concert for them. And I've been looking for ideas. I need a spark to get me going. And suddenly something came to me on the phone. So I just tapped the dictation button and sung into the phone.
When you play saxophone, do you sing, when you're jazzing around notes, do you sing it in your head and it comes out through the saxophone?
What I say to people in workshops is that if you'd like to improvise, you do not need a saxophone to improvise. It just happens to be that the noise I make in a saxophone is much nicer than my singing voice. But actually, all I'm doing is imagining what it is I might be singing, but making the noise on a saxophone instead.
Yeah.
So if I was to play a do-da-da, 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 and my fingers have just done what was required for that phrase in my head to come out of a saxophone. And I can practice saxophone without even a saxophone in my hand, just by moving my fingers. And I can know I've made a mistake, even without a saxophone there.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea of the basic competent of improvisation is you have to imagine the melody that you're about to play, and then you have to get it to come out in midair. And you can either do it with your voice, boo ba ba boo ba, or with a saxophone, e-g-g, e-g. So it's very similar. And I try and get people to sing out loud, even if they're instrumentalists and their singing voice is not a professional singing voice at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you can't imagine the shape of the melody and the rhythm of the melody that you're about to put through your instrument, then you're going to have a hard time improvising.
Did you always know you were better than other people playing? Was it a naturally gifted thing that you were already above other players, or did you have to really work at it?
In my case, I did a lot of work in the first place, but I think I'm very privileged to have what's known in the trade as good ears. I can hear something and I can remember it. I mean, I have certain musical attributes which I think I'm very good at, and certain things which I think I'm not very good at. There are some people who are more classically trained and can sight read anything, the most complicated thing. And I sometimes struggle with that. My sight reading, and my problem is now, most of the work I do doesn't involve regular sight reading. I'm often playing with Sax Appeal, I've written it already, playing with Jules Holland, we'll do roughly the same set for a 2 month period. So once I've got it under my fingers, I'll know what's coming up. Or I might be doing something where I'm the guest with a house rhythm section, playing what's called Jazz Standards, the Great American Songbook. Well, they're all in my head.
Yeah.
I carry around a huge pile of music with me and then hardly ever look at it, because most of it I remember. So when it comes to sight reading, I only do it once every month. Does somebody actually say, right, now play exactly this piece of music? Now, for the guys that work in the West End shows, they do that all the time.
Yeah.
Or they're, you know, the session guys that do that, that's one of their fortes, but they can't necessarily improvise. I'm perfect on a gig where you just need 2 hours of music and there's no dots around at all. I can do it.
Yeah.
But my sight reading. So I have a special area, and I always knew I was good at that, and I sometimes find it hard to say, well, yeah, you must remember that. You can hear how the chord sequence goes, can't you? Because I can.
Yeah.
I'm just very lucky to have very talented ears. But I work hard at the sight reading. If I know I've got a concert coming up, I'm doing something soon. I'm playing for another saxophone player, Chris Rand, very good boogie-woogie player. I works with Ben Waters, and he's launching his album. I did a couple of tracks on the album, and he's asked me to guest with him. I will make sure I get all the music in advance, and I will practice it, and I will practice hard. It's the same with the Ronnie Scott's Blues Explosion. Suddenly we've got a new guest, and I've got several new things to play. I will sit at home and practice at home. I know that's what I have to do my job as professionally as I can.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trust myself, and I don't want to trust myself and put myself under the stress of really hard sight reading immediately.
Yeah.
But the improvising thing for me, I suppose that's... Oh, can I say I'm talented? That sounds incredibly...
Gift, it's a gift.
Gift. I think I'm lucky enough that my ears work extremely well and they don't let me down very often.
Now, we're going to play the first bit of music. We've got a couple of tracks coming up. The Derek Nash Acoustic Quartet. You've got to dig it, to dig it, you dig.
Yeah,
see, I just managed to get that out.
You see, there's a whole reason for that phrase. People don't know. They think it's a slightly bizarre title. This comes from an amazing thing. The whole album was inspired. It's called, look it up on the internet, just put Thelonious Monk, who's the famous piano player, Thelonious Monk Notes. And in 1961, Steve Lacy, who's another amazing saxophone player, went to a workshop situation where Thelonious Monk talked to the audience. Now, being Thelonious Monk, he's fairly idiosyncratic and he would say bizarre things. So whereas as a on the jazz course, I might talk to you and say, right, you need to be able to play a C7 here, and the dominant seventh is the B flat, not the major seventh, which is the B natural, and you have to understand, we talk technically about music. Monk would say, and this is directly verbatim from this list, the inside of the tune is the part that makes the outside sound good.
Right.
Okay. And then he would say, like, make the drummer sound good.
Mm.
Now, actually, they're very valid points in a strange kind of way. Don't play the piano part. I'm playing that. I'm supposed to be accompanying you. And right in the middle of this, right in the middle of this was this one phrase, and you just said, you gotta dig it to dig it. You dig.
Mm.
So that's Thelonious Monk's words on how to play jazz. You gotta dig it to dig it. You dig. And I loved the rhythm of that sentence, and because it sounds so quirky. So I ended up using the rhythm of those words to write the main line, the chorus hook of this melody. And a lot of the other things, there's a track on there called Let Some Things Go By, which is just what he said.
Yep.
And I was talking to Sebastian, who hasn't joined in properly yet, who's a young up-and-coming saxophone player. And I said, there are 13 notes that you can play on a saxophone, the 12 notes and the one which is called silence. Let some things go by. Shut up. Don't play for a bit, and the magic will happen around you from the rhythm section. And a lot of musicians forget that silence is the 13th note that's available for you.
Yes, especially sometimes when you're doing a gig and you've got the drummer tapping in the background forever.
Yeah.
Always a problem, the drummer, always a problem. Absolutely brilliant. Now, you guys are going to be playing on the 8th of March at the Barswell Social Club.
Yeah, yeah. Gig right in Brentwood.
Yep.
For the fabulous Susan May, who runs lots of... she's been a staunch supporter of jazz, who's promoted so much, so many gigs and so many... given musicians so much work for so many years. And in fact, her late husband, Spike Robinson, was incredibly influential with me.
Yeah.
And he's another Essex boy. Well, American by birth from Colorado, but he lived in Essex for the last few years of his life. And we had a band together called Young Lions, Old Tigers, at which point I was then the young lion and he was the old tiger. But old tigers can teach young lions lots of tricks.
Yeah.
He taught me so much about poise and elegance. He was such a beautiful melodic player in the mould of Stan Getz and Ben Webster and people like that, that I learnt so much in that band we were together. And really, it was through him that I got my introduction to many of the grassroots jazz clubs throughout the entire country. He was kind enough to say, you know, you respect me as a player, well, here's a young guy who's I consider to be a good player. So I had his seal of approval, and that was such an important way. And I try to pass that on now as a young saxophone player called Harry Green, who's Essex-Suffolk border, very young guy. He's not even been to music college. He's just got through, and he's going to music college in London next year. But his band came and did the support for my band last Saturday, and he's a fantastic young player, and he's going to go very far. He's going to steal all my work very soon.
We don't want him doing that. We don't want him doing that.